come by.
The battery door was unlocked. All right, so Hebrews chapter 12. Well, I was going to tell you a funny joke, but now we've already had a good laugh, so I'll save that joke for a better day. All right, somebody, and go. If you've got a pen, if you don't have a pen, there's probably one in the seat back in front of you. I didn't type this outline very well, so the title didn't make it on there, so I'm going to give you the title. And I have to wonder if it was by providence that the title didn't make it on there, because God's given me one last chance to change it. Because me and Kelly disagreed about which one of us had the best title. So my title was Nearsighted. Y'all can ask her for her title later. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 17 says, "Afterward, as you know, when he wanted to inherit this blessing, he was rejected. Even though he sought the blessing with tears, he could not change what he had done." This is, the he in this story is Esau. So let's go back to the Old Testament, Jacob and Esau. And we will today. We're going to spend a lot of our time today in the story of Jacob and Esau. But when I saw this in Hebrews, I thought, wow, this is really interesting. Life is full of choices. You know, they say that the average American adult makes somewhere in the neighborhood of 35,000 decisions in a single day. So those of you who have been called indecisive, you should feel a little bit better about yourself, because even you indecisive people probably make at least 10,000 if the rest of us are making 35,000. Now, most of those choices, most of those 35,000 decisions are not life or death kind of decisions. They don't change the course of eternity, but some do. The author of Hebrews here, which we don't know, and I could incite a riot between Pastor and Miss Susan because I believe they disagree on who wrote Hebrews, based on some of my experiences here on Wednesday nights. A lot of people believe it was the Apostle Paul. Some people believe that it was Apollos. I'm not going to get through the whole list of who believes what, but we don't know, so I can't tell you. But the author was writing the book of Hebrews to build the case for the superiority of Jesus Christ. That in him, this new covenant that we have is so much better than anything we ever had before. And he's building it, and he's exhorting, and he's pushing, and he's saying, this is a great thing. And then we get to Hebrews chapter 11, which is the hall of fame of faith. So as you go through the 11th chapter of Hebrews, you see all the most faithful people in the Bible talked about through this 11th chapter of Hebrews. And then we get into chapter 12, and midway through chapter 12, we get to our text. Really, you need to go back and read verses 14 through 18, through 17 to get the full grip of it, but we don't have that kind of time today, so you're going to have to trust me a little bit. But what he's giving warning to here today, he's talking about how you make choices. He's talking about what's your frame of perspective. He's talking about, are you looking far down the road or are you looking in the right here and right now? And what better case study to consider that question than Esau? In case you're relatively new and you go, who is Jacob and Esau? I'm going to tell you. We're going to look at a choice that this brother Esau made. They were twin brothers in the Old Testament, go way back, Genesis, They were sons of Isaac. And we have an occurrence here where we see Esau make a choice that changes his life, changes his eternity, changes the course of history in one choice. You see, when Esau, he was a hunter. And he would go out and he would go into the fields and he would hunt. And he was a man's man. You know, this is like the guy who would have had his own channel, his own TV show on the Outdoor Channel. He was like the, oh man, Bill Dance, right? That was the fisherman, right? Okay. He was like Bill Dance was to bass fishing. This guy was to hunting. You know what I mean? And so this is, just out of curiosity, how many of y'all know who Bill Dance is? Let me refocus. The people who are below 25, any of y'all know who Bill Dance is? He was the greatest thing in the world to catch a Sunday afternoon nap by. Just saying. My folks loved him, and I love to sleep. Yeah, moving on. So Jacob and Esau, they were these twin brothers, and I could get into a whole lot of this, but I'm trying to keep it quick, so I'm not going to. But they were twin brothers. They fought in their mother's womb. In one place it talks about that there were two nations warring in her womb. And she went, why are these babies going nuts? You know, this was before Mexican food, so we couldn't blame it on that, right? So she's like, why are these babies going crazy in here? And she told her, there's two nations warring in your womb. And then they come out. And this is really cool. I mean, like, I'm not, just so y'all know, I'm not real good with the childbirth process. My wife starts talking about it, and she gets like four sentences in. I'm like, you're going to have to stop, babe. I can't handle this. I nearly passed out at Kennedy's birth. At Connor's, the doctor, she said, the delivery doctor, she said, you want to cut the cord? I said, let me tell you how this first one went. I said, when my first child was birthed, my head was on the mattress. And the nurse said, if you pass out, we'll deal with you later. That's how this went. I said, so let me tell you, if I can just live through the birth, I don't care about cutting no cord. And she said, we'll see how you do. You know. So anyway, so I'm not real good with this. But anyways, so when this baby comes out, when Esau come out, he was the firstborn. So when Esau came out, Jacob was grabbing hold to his heel. That had to be kind of odd, didn't it? But anyways, it's being real. So these two were constantly warring. And they're very different. You know, Kennedy asked me, she said, were they identical twins? I said, nope, they were nothing like identical twins. They could not have been more opposite. They were fraternal twins. But anyway, so you have Jacob who hung around the house with mom, mama's boy. And he liked to cook and he liked to hang around and he was a pretty good chef. And he had Esau who would go out and hunt and, you know, Tim the Tool Man Taylor kind of guy, you know what I'm saying? But Esau, he had the birthright. And we're going to get into a few minutes what this birthright was. But so this is how the story goes down. So Esau's out hunting. He comes back. He's hungry. He's famished. He's starved. He's like, I'm about to die. Like, well, if you was a good hunter, sorry. Jacob, that soup you're cooking smells awfully good, brother. I need some. Jacob, being an entrepreneur, says, aha. I see my opportunity. So he says, I'll be happy to give you some, but I'll sell it to you. Well, what price? I mean, I'm dying here. So all you got to do is give me your birthright. So you got to give me. Just give me your birthright. It's like, what good's a birthright if I'm a dead man? Give me the soup, brother. You can have it. It's yours, you know. Do I got to gift wrap it or can you just take it now? He said, swear to me. You know, that was the let's get it in ink. You know, you. Hungry man will say anything, but if I can get him to sign a contract, he can't back off of it. So swear to me that you'll give me your birthright. So that's the story. That's the story that the author of Hebrews is calling back to. So he's speaking to a current church, and he's saying, you know, this way of Jesus is so superior. This way of Jesus is, I mean, it's the best thing since sliced bread with strawberry jelly on it. I mean, this is great. But because it's so great, we need to make sure we process how we make choices to stick with it. So he throws back to this story in the Old Testament they all would have known. So as we consider this, I want us to think. I want us to imagine just for a second. I want you to don't close your eyes because I'm tired and hungry. If I close my eyes, I'm going to sleep. So if you will imagine, this is heavy, okay? I'm just going to tell you right now, this is heavy. In one place in the Bible, it says God said, Jacob I have loved, Esau I have hated. It's heavy, right? So I know I get real uncomfortable when we start making predictions about where people are spending eternity. So you'll rarely hear me do that. But we believe that Esau is probably not going to be one of the guys sitting at the table with us when we get to heaven. So if you could imagine then where he is right now. So if you could, and I say right now, like right now, because remember, eternity is eternity. Even though he died thousands of years ago, he is in eternity right now. So if you could look right now into the horrific halls of hell, I believe that you might would find Esau shoving morsel of food after morsel of food into his face, trying to figure out how to feel this insatiable hunger. Because you see, that hunger is what ruled his life. That hunger, and he's always hungry for eternity. Just piece of bread after piece of bread. Just trying to, because remember, we see here in this story what drove his heart. He comes in from the field, and he is willing to sell the birthright for that. And so this story stands as a lesson to us. It's a warning to us that we must subdue the carnality of our life. We must subdue that thing that's inside of us that tells us to gratify the flesh. We must subdue that in favor of pursuing something eternal, something that is so much more grand than what the moment of carnality has to present to us. In short, we must not sell what's precious for a mere bowl of bean soup. So let's jump in and let's start looking at the parts of this story so we can understand how it applies to us. So the value of the birthright. See, the birthright in the family carried economic, social, and spiritual blessings. The son with a birthright, he occupied the most cherished position in the family. So when we look at what Esau was willing to sell, he was selling the prized seat. He was selling what would benefit him on so many levels. He took in this moment, this one moment of weakness, and he was willing to barter something that was his economic future. So the birthright in this culture, now I know we don't get into the birthright stuff a whole lot today. You know, we're all about equality and making it on your own and all that stuff. But this wasn't the society back then. The society back then, let's do some simple math. If you had, I'm tired, I can't do simple math. So if you had three sons, you would take your inheritance, so all the stuff that you had amassed, and you would divide it into four pieces. Not three, you divide it into four. And you give your oldest son, you give him two, and you would give the other two a piece and a piece. So what you have happen in that situation is, if I had three sons, you know, in America, each of them would get a third, right? Because we all love our children equally, right? We do not have favorites. Yeah, neither one of mine are in here. We do not have favorites. We give them all the same thing, right? But not back then. We had favorites. So everybody would have gotten a third. But no. Son two and son three get a quarter, not a third. For those of you who don't do fractions so well, a quarter is less than a third, okay? But son one gets half, which is greater than a third. So son one gets half of everything, son two gets a quarter, and son three gets a quarter. Son two and son three, not like son one very much, just saying. But anyway, so that's the society, that's how it worked, okay? So from an economic perspective, man, you wanted to be the firstborn because you got half of everything, right? Okay, So from the social perspective, if you were the firstborn, you were like junior dad. You had father-like authority over the other siblings of the family. It didn't matter, good, bad, or indifferent, that was your position of authority. So it had a social benefit as well. And then spiritually, because you were dad too, you were the priest of the family. So remember, God's design was that the priesthood be passed down firstborn to firstborn to firstborn. So The birthright carried all of those implications, and yet he was willing to trade that. That's, man, the birthright was valuable. Something else that's interesting about this particular birthright. So remember, Isaac is Abraham's son. God gave Abraham a promise, right? That through his seed, all nations would be blessed. I mean, this is the beginning of the Messiah's line, right? And so whenever we look at where Esau was in the lineage of Jesus Christ. Besides just being the priest of the family, he was given the opportunity by God, birth, you know, he came out first. He had a place in the very line of Jesus Christ. That promise had been given to Abraham flowed down even to Esau. That's, you know, just track it back through. So we see that he had this great desirable thing. Like he had the greatest bargaining chip ever. Like if you're going to bet, if you're going to come to a negotiating table, like you got to know, like I got to have a good card. He had a good card. You know what I mean? Like he had what we call leverage in the business world. Now let's look at the other side. Let's look at what Jacob brought to the table. Jacob brought to the table chunky soup. I'm just saying. Now look here, I love me some chunky soup. You know, soup's very good for you. If you're trying to like eat healthy, I'm just telling you soup's a great option. But I love, like, especially if we can get like a good clam chowder. Because my wife don't let me eat clam chowder in the house. She said it stinks the house up. But I love a good soup. But that's what Jacob brought to the table. So what was the value of the bean soup? The value of the beans. What? I mean, this, like, I don't know if you're like me, but I'm looking at this going, is this real? Like, come on now. Is this real? Well, it's in the Bible, so we know it's real. But I mean, really, how do you end up this way? Esau was hungry and exhausted. And that bean soup met an intense physical need. Because he was so carnally minded, because he was so in tune with his flesh, that superseded the spiritual implications of everything else in his life. This story is in Genesis chapter 25, so let's run over there right quick. Starting in verse 29, it says, "Once when Jacob was cooking some stew, Esau came in from the open country, famished. He said to Jacob, 'Quick, let me have some of that red stew. I'm famished.'" This is why he was also called Edom. Jacob replied, "First, sell me your birthright." "Look, I'm about to die," Esau said. "What good is the birthright to me?" But Jacob said, "Swear to me first." So he swore an oath to him, selling his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau some bread and some lentil stew. He ate and drank and then got up and left. So Esau despised his birthright. So he comes in famished. He comes in exhausted. He had been out hunting and tracking, and it doesn't say that he came in with a kill, so I'm going to presume that he didn't this day. And here he is, hungry. He was exhausted. And now he's starving. I'm sure, like, I don't know if you've ever been hungry, but I can tell you right now that if someone walked in here with a bucket of fried chicken, I'd give an altar call right now. I didn't bring a hot plate intentionally. But can you imagine when Esau came in and he was exhausted and worn out and tired? See, that's how our, notice, it's a sensory response, right? It's all physical. So he walked in, and let me tell you something. That's how temptation comes. It comes in that sensory. It calls to your flesh man. It doesn't come looking for your spirit man. It comes looking for your flesh man. Because if you can get a hold of the flesh man, you can do what you want to with the spirit man. So So he comes in and goes, I got to have it. Probably began to salivate. Man, them taste buds probably jumped up on in. He's like, man, my brother, he's a good cook, and he done cooked something good. Now, you know, like you know, Christmas dinner, right? Every one of y'all love walking by that grill out there and smelling Pastor and Ernest out there grilling that prime rib. That's where the man was. I'm sure that that soup was good, but this encounter isn't about the soup. See, Esau valued, the soup is just, this gives us a telescope, a viewpoint down into the heart, down into the spirit of the man. Esau valued the way he felt in the moment. See, he had a need. Those beans represented the fulfillment of the need. And so he pursued the need. This brought to light something much deeper in Esau's life. He was literally ruled by his flesh. When it came to satisfying the flesh, he was willing to pay whatever the price. If the price would soothe the compulsion inside of him, it would be worth it to him. The man who cannot deny his flesh, the man who cannot control his physical responses, that man is a man ripe for moral failure. I'm just laying out, if you can't tell your body no, then it's only a matter of time. We must mortify the flesh. That means kill it. Our spirit man must have control over these vessels that God has created. So let's move towards the close. So the value of the perspective. In Hebrews, the story from Genesis is referenced as a warning against giving into temporary carnal desires, thereby forfeiting the inheritance that the believer has in Christ. I believe we have here a failure to appreciate the gravity of the situation on Esau's part. Esau associated little value with his birthright. From his perspective, the birthright wasn't giving him much at that moment anyhow. His dad was still alive and doing well. The value of the birthright was a future tense consideration to him. The here and now is what held priority for him. And in the here and now, he was hungry. He wasn't worried about tomorrow. He was living for today. There's a, every once in a while I get the opportunity to do this. I love music, by the way. And it hasn't always been Christian music, just being honest. I know none of you listen to anything that's not Christian, I know. There's a particular artist who one line in a song drives me nuts. It so grades against my Christian beliefs. He says, I would rather die while I'm living than to live when I'm dead. You know, I was young and dumb. I didn't know what he was saying. But the closer I've gotten to Jesus, the easier it is to understand that. I hear that when I read this story. Esau didn't want to die hungry, and for whatever reason, maybe he felt like he was really going to die. Maybe he was just a big baby. I don't know. But it would have been better for him to have died hungry than to have forfeited what God had given him. See, Esau stands in history as the epitome of nearsightedness. The sobering sentiment of the monument of his life is this: even he eventually came to regret his choice. By the time he regretted it, though, it was too late. He had already done it. As we reflect on Esau's choice to relinquish his birthright, this was a privilege that couldn't be bought. That choice carried with it tremendous implications in society, economics, and even the familial leadership. We see a situation that leads to heartache and disappointment. Eventually, Esau matured and understood what he had given up. He saw the bad deal that he had made. And although he begged for a different outcome, it was too late. What he had done in a moment cost him eternity. See, when we understand the nuts and bolts of what happened back in Genesis. And we understand the audience that the writer in Hebrews is speaking to. I think we begin to see how this applies to our life today. So you remember, in Hebrews, we're building the case, man, this Jesus thing is awesome. It's a new covenant. It's a new work. It's a great thing. Jesus is Lord of everything. We have all this hope. We have a life to come. The kingdom is all this. It's a birthright. Let me just lay that out there. It's a birthright. The case of Hebrews is this is Esau's birthright. What we have as followers of Jesus Christ is that birthright. So when you listen to what socially the birthright was, even you can assess, even from outside of our culture today, looking back, you go, wow, that was a really good thing to have. Can I say that the author of Hebrews is saying, hey, yo, this life with Jesus is a really good thing to have. Like, you cannot find anything better than this. In the culture he was writing to, there was nothing better than the birthright. There was nothing more coveted than the birthright. So he has drawn a parallel between the birthright and the believer's inheritance. And so when we understand that those two are the parallel tracks, now let's step back and see, well, what's the bowl of soup? Oh, man. As I begin to bring this to a close, I'm going to share a story that I heard Chip Ingram. He's a mega church pastor out in California. I heard him share this years ago. I'm going to give you a shorthand version of it, okay? So he was counseling a terminally ill patient. And so the patient was in a family, and the family had gone to Chip's church and had found Jesus, but the patient, he wasn't. He wasn't into this Jesus thing. And so Chip was talking to him, and he was trying to, you know, he did all the ABCs, and he did all the formulas and everything. And finally, this guy did something that few pastors ever get the opportunity to hear. The guy looked back at him and said, man, that sounds really good. And I know I got like 6 months to live. But I'm just going to be honest with you. I think it's 2 or 3 sins. I'm just not ready to give up. Let me just tell you, in evangelism, you hope to get that kind of honesty because at least now you know what you're working with. You know? Put the smoke screens down. Said, look, man, the cold hard facts are there's a few things I really like to do. That if I get saved, I'm going to have to give up. And I'm just not ready to give them up. And so Chip's like, all right, well, you know, so draws out the plan of salvation. It's like, but I'm not going to push any further. We'll talk later. Here's my number. Call me when you're ready. And so, you know, a month later, they were talking again. And the guy said, you know, I've been thinking about what you said. I said, okay. He said, I still don't know if I'm ready to give those things up yet. Chip said, okay, well, let me just kind of paint it to you this way. Let's try something different. Is your wife a believer? Yeah. Yeah. Your kids. You got 2 kids. Are they believers? So, yeah, yeah, yeah. So where are they going when they die? So, well, they're going to heaven. Okay. So you understand it, right? And based on everything we've talked about right now, if you were to die right now, where are you headed? I'm headed to hell. I'm just drawing out here in a scale for you. Those 2 or 3 sins that you really enjoy doing, are they worth? Like, you know, if you keep doing them, you're going to not spend eternity with your wife and kids and, you know, Jesus. And the guy was like, it's pretty dumb, isn't it? Chip's like, hey, man, those are your words, not mine. But can I say that it's a little easier to see that stuff when you're in a terminally ill perspective? And I grappled with this. I said, Lord, why do you want me to teach this on Memorial Day weekend? You know, the only people that come to church on Memorial Day weekend, they're the good folk. You know, I mean, even the good folk, some of them traveling for vacation. I'm not throwing stones at them. Don't y'all misquote me. I was like, Lord, I mean, like, this is, you know. I'm seeing, I don't know about you, but I'm seeing in the lives of people around me, people who have had the taste of salvation. People who have been given a tremendous inheritance. People who have been put in right standing with God. And they are now making choices to give up that birthright in pursuit of what feels good right now. And I go, you know, I really don't want to be this harsh. I really don't want to, like, let's be honest. This stone hits me too. Because, you know, we all make eternal choices. And we all walk out of this building and go into a real world. And we all walk into a place where the soup smells really good. The author of Hebrews, in great, you know, the Bible is written by some really good writers, I'm just saying. I can appreciate the lyrical form of what he's doing here. He's speaking to the church and he's saying, you have the birthright. I get that temptations are in front of you. I get that persecution is on top of you. I get that there is pressure and that there is great opportunity to pursue the now, to be focused, to be nearsighted and look at the now. But I'm challenging you to look down the road to eternity, because I have spent 11 chapters telling you how awesome this life with Jesus is. Here's my one caveat. Here's my one little off of the how great Jesus is don't you dare trade Jesus for a bowl of soup. In the moment, just like Esau, in the moment, I promise you it's not going to look like a bowl of soup. In the moment, when that temptation is in front of you, it's not going to look like throwing your marriage away. It's not going to look like walking out on your kids. It's not going to look like being unethical with your finances. It's not going to look like giving up eternity. It's going to look like, but I have a need right now and it needs to be fulfilled. The author of Hebrews says, it'd be better for you to die hungry with a birthright than to go to hell trying to fill your belly. I'm going to ask you guys if you will stand up and bow your heads. I told you I was going to try and make it quick today. What I have grappled with this word, I keep in front of me this image of this ruddy-complexioned Esau sitting in torment, shoving food, morsel, whatever he can get his hands on in his mouth, trying to fulfill that hunger. Regretting for eternity the choice that he made. And I sense that the Holy Spirit, like, I really hate to say it this way, but even when I was praying last night at my desk, it's hard for me to think about it like this. But I'm worried that there is one, two, maybe a handful that is either at the negotiating table right now, or Lord help, has just walked away from the negotiating table and brokered a bad deal. And that's crazy for me to think about, because I know a lot of y'all. And I think, oh, dear Lord. But I believe God has given this word specifically for those who are looking at that negotiating table. And you may be hungry, and you may be famished, and you may be thinking, but I have this need that has to be filled right now. And today God says to you, you have the birthright. Don't you dare sell it for something so temporary. Don't you dare sell out for something that when you look back 5 years from now, you can go, gee, that was dumb. Don't you listen. Your stomach may be gnawing a hole in your spine telling you you're hungry. Don't you listen to it. For you, if you are a follower of Jesus Christ, you have been given an inheritance that cannot be matched by anything on this planet. So I struggled. I said, Lord, what do I invite them to? This morning, Debbie and them, they're going to sing here in just a second. And when they sing, this is your invitation. If you are sitting at the negotiating table right now, or if you look into your future and you see a table there, if you're even considering negotiating with this birthright, I'm just going to be straight with you. You need to come spend some time with Jesus. And so I'm going to invite you here, and I will pray with you. We got other folk here who will pray with you. But if you can even see a negotiating table in your future, you need to be in an altar preparing for that. Because when you come in and you're hungry, it's going to be hard for you to say no. So as they sing, this is your invitation. If you are at the negotiating table about to barter away that birthright, I urge you to come here today. You come here today and commit to the Lord that you will not even sit at that table. If you're sitting at that table, you come here today and say, Lord, I'm out. I will cherish this great thing that you have given me so freely. I will cherish it and I will hold on to it and I will never barter it. For it's not a token to be bartered with. So as they sing, this is your invitation. You come on.